brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
I've evolved as a coach to where we don't do a lot of drills. We do a lot of competitive five-on-five stuff, and if I feel the need to stop it, I will stop it, correct things kind of in a five-on-five situation, not necessarily a one-on-one or two-on-two situation. I think kids want to play. They want to play five-on-five, and if I want them to come to practice every day, I've got to make it fun. I've got to make it worthwhile.
Mike DeWitt just completed his 24th season as the head men's basketball coach at Ohio Wesleyan University, where he has compiled a record of 386 and 249. Including his time as the head coach at Hiram and Center College, DeWitt has an overall record of 436 and 325 over 29 seasons. He has also served as an assistant men's basketball coach at Kenyon College for 2 seasons, and was an assistant coach at Ohio Wesleyan for 3 seasons prior to that. During his playing career, DeWitt was a member of 3 conference championship teams. He was a 2-time All-NCAC selection at Ohio Wesleyan, and helped the Bishops win NCAC championships in 85-86 and 86-87. He began his playing career at Wittenberg University and was a member of the Tigers' 1982-83 team that reached the NCAA Division III championship game. Hey, Hoopheads! This March, our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball are offering $2,000 off the Dr. Dish All-Star, Rebel, and CT+. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT Plus models. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details.
Hi, this is Asim Rastogi from Essential Coaching, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new FastDraw and FastScout. FastDraw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off FastDraw and FastScout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improve communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball. Get ready to jot down some notes as you listen to this episode with Mike DeWitt, head men's basketball coach at Ohio Wesleyan University. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel tonight, and we are pleased to welcome the head men's basketball coach at Ohio Wesleyan University here in the state of Ohio, Mike DeWitt. Mike, welcome to the Hoopheads pod.
Thanks, Mike. I'm pleased to join you guys tonight.
We are excited to have you on. Looking forward to diving into all the things that you've been able to do throughout your basketball career. Let's go back in time to when you were a kid. Tell us a little bit about how you got into the game of basketball and what some of your earliest memories are of the game.
It's kind of funny you asked that. As I've watched some of your podcasts, I knew this question was coming, so I tried to have a really good story about this. And
good. I'm looking forward to it.
My actual first memory as a human being was having my parents let me stay up past my bedtime to watch the Knicks-Lakers 1970 Game 7 NBA Finals game, which is known as the Willis Reed game at this point, where he was injured in Game 6. They didn't know if he was going to play, and he came out for the Knicks and scored 2 baskets to start the game against Wilt Chamberlain. And they went on to win the NBA championship that year, and that ignited certainly a love for the game of basketball in my life, and obviously has led to me making that a profession and a lifelong pursuit. So I'm really dating myself with that story, but because I was 5 years old at the time, got to wear my Knicks t-shirt to kindergarten the next day, and everyone thought that was the coolest thing in the world. But that kind of ignited a passion to play the game of basketball, and that was the start of it.
That's a pretty good memory. Pretty good game to remember as your first memory. Yeah. My first memory as a human being is not quite as exciting. It's me sitting in a kindergarten bus looking out the window. That's my first memory. So yours, remembering the Willis Reed game, is a little bit better story than the one I've got, Mike.
You know what my first memory is, Mike? I got my first memory.
All right, what is
it? I love that.
Jumping off a swing barefoot when I was 4 years old, 4 or 5 years old, and ending up breaking my foot. Right. That's what I remember.
All right, well, Mike definitely trumps yours and he trumps mine without question. His is way better.
That's awesome. So at the time, we lived in New York. I was actually born in New York, and my family lived in Long Island. And it wasn't it was soon after that we actually moved to Ohio. So I was probably the only Knicks fan in my I guess adopted Ohio hometown of Galleon, which where I spent my childhood.
Were your parents both basketball fans, or?
Yeah, my dad was a fan. He, you know, he wasn't a coach or anything like that. And my mom had very little interest in athletics except for driving me to everything during my young life. But they typical parents. They supported everything I did and every sport I played as I was growing up in Galleon. But you know, my dad was a huge Knicks fan, a huge New York fan, Yankees, New York Giants, like that kind of stuff. So, so when we moved to Ohio, we had that kind of, you know, we were the only New York fans around the state of Ohio, I think. But, you know, it was good to have, you know, someone who was so interested in athletics supporting it, you know, me, who was their oldest son. And like I said, everything from basketball to baseball to football to tennis as I was growing up.
Yeah, that parental support is huge. It's funny because talking about being a New York fan here in the state of Ohio. So for whatever reason, I've never really been a Yankees fan, but for some reason I've always liked Yankees gear. So when I was in college, I used to have a Yankees starter jacket that I would wear around all the time. And then even during the height of like when the Indians were really good in the 90s, and that was at the age where I was in my mid-20s, so I'd be going out downtown or being around when there were games going on, and I would always wear my Yankees hat. And even today, I still have a Yankees hat that I'll wear around, and it's amazing the vitriol that
I'm disappointed, Mike. I'm disappointed. I didn't know.
Listen, see, this is what I get all the time, Mike. No matter where I go, people are like, well, and I really like, you know, meeting or having this conversation, but man, that hat, I mean, I'm not so sure. I'm not so sure about that hat. I'm like, oh, it's just a hat, man. I'm like, I just like the hat. So I can totally relate to if you were expressing your New York fandom, that you were probably getting people that were looking at you a little sideways.
For sure. Like that, I wouldn't dare wear a Yankees hat in the place I grew up with. Right now, so you have a lot more guts than I did growing up.
I kind of liked it. I kind of like people coming up to me and giving me, you know, giving me some business. They're like, hey, you know, anyway.
That's fine.
All right. So was basketball always number one when you were a kid? I know you mentioned that you're playing lots of things. Your parents are getting everywhere. But was basketball from the time you were little, was it always number one, or did it kind of evolve that way over time?
It was always number one. And like I said, I played a lot of different things growing up, as I think most people my age did, and I think kids still should do, even though a lot of them don't. Yeah, basketball, you know, played in elementary school and middle school and up into high school. It was always my first choice, and any other sport I played was secondary to that and had to fit around my basketball schedule. In a town that was, you know, a small town, Galleon, Ohio, that was really good in football. Then actually won the state championship like at least once, during that time. But I was a basketball guy through and through, played it, you know, winter, spring, summer, fall by myself, going to the YMCA, on the playgrounds, that kind of stuff. That was definitely my love and where I thought I could, you know, become a good high school player. That was the main goal when I was growing up, and was fortunate enough to have some success at that level.
What's your favorite memory from being a high school basketball player? Do you have one that sticks out?
For sure. So I had a up and down, I guess, success level growing up. When I was sixth, seventh grade, I was the best player on all those teams. And then I stopped growing and everybody else kept growing. And my sophomore year at Galleon High School, I was the 20th person on a 20-man varsity and JV roster. Didn't get a chance to play a whole lot. Was really, you know, second guessing. Could I play at even the high school level? But started growing. And by the time I was a junior, I was the 7th, 8th person on the team, playing a little bit on a admittedly average high school team. But we played in the sectional tournament that year at Ashland University. And back then the sectional tournament was a big deal. It wasn't just one game. You had to win like 3 games to win the sectional championship. We won a couple games. And the 3rd game, we were playing Lexington High School, who was ranked 4th in the state in AAA. Again, dating myself.
Yeah.
That was
old
big school level, big school level. You know, and we were playing Lexington at Ashland and hanging in there. And I didn't play much, but I made a couple baskets. And then at the end of the game with 8 seconds to go, my high school coach put me in. We're down 1. With the ball, and we're trying to work the ball to our 2 best players, and they're both like double teamed, and I'm wide open at the elbow, and the point guard passed me the ball, and I shot it and made it and won the game, won the sectional championship against number 14 in the state.
That's awesome.
And it was just, again, every time I go to Ashland University, whether it's for recruiting now or camps or whatever, I don't tear up, but it just brings back such great memories. Like I go over and walk to that spot 15 feet away from the basket where I made that shot. And I'm like, wow, that was pretty cool for a high school kid to have happened to him. And frankly, it spurred me on to work even harder at becoming a good player, because I didn't want to be that guy who just made a shot his junior year and everybody forgot about him. So I worked hard over the summer, went to a lot of open gyms, a lot of playgrounds, that kind of stuff. And had a great senior year where I averaged like, I think 18, 19 points a game. It was all district, all state, not all state. I'm sorry, all conference. Just had it kind of spurred me to be motivated enough that moment, at least, to become a good player, not just have to kind of be a one-shot wonder, so to speak.
That's very cool. I mean, I can feel your passion and excitement even today, whatever it is, 35 yeah. years later. I can still feel that feeling that you have, and I know that as a player, I can relate to those moments and think about things that happened to me as a player that when I go back and I think about them, or in some cases I can still watch them on video every once in a while, you still kind of yep. get those goosebumps, you get that feel like yeah. there's nothing that ever really replaces that. And you kind of continue to the experience that for somebody who hasn't gotten to experience those moments as a
yep.
high school athlete or college athlete or whatever it may be. There's just nothing like it. And then the fact that you use that as a springboard to be able to continue to improve and use it as a way to motivate yourself to continue to move on in your career, I think is interesting, and also something that is not surprising when you start talking about what it means to be a high school basketball player. You've talked a couple times, and this is a topic that we've talked about, Mike, a lot on the podcast, is just comparing and contrasting the way that somebody from our era grew up in the game of basketball as a young kid going through sort of youth basketball, which there really wasn't much youth basketball when you and I were growing up, compared to the way kids grow up in the game today, where you were driving around and riding your bike and trying to find games and playing pickup basketball or playing on the driveway. And now today kids are in the gym and there's probably a coach with them and there's probably parents in the stands and all those things. So when you think about the two systems and you think about the way that you grew up and you think about the way that kids grow up in the game, just talk a little bit about your feelings about it, whether you want to highlight some of the positives of each system and just sort of what you've experienced yourself growing up and then now what you see as a college coach kind of looking at how the landscape has changed over time.
Yeah, you put it very well. I think there are positives to both ways, the way things were done back in the day and the way things are done now. And you hit it exactly on the head. Like when I was trying to develop as a player, it wasn't a lot of personal coaches and organized open gyms and things like that. It was getting up early in the morning, going to the playground, going to other towns and finding games and finding open gyms. And I shouldn't even say open gyms. It was, you know, running at the playground.
Exactly.
There were 50 guys there and you had to win to stay on or else you weren't going to play for 2 hours. And then those games were competitive. And I think that those experiences helped people and players from that era really learn how to play the game of basketball and do the things you needed to do to win games. Comparing that to today where a lot of kids, you know, have, you know, they have personal coaches, they go to personal workouts, the open gym they go to, like you said, are supervised by high school coaches. And it's just a different, it's a different skill development, as opposed to what it was, you know, 20, 30 years ago. I think both have, merit, but I think when I'm, you know, as a college, head college coach, like I'm, one of the things I have to teach our guys is doing the things they need to do to win games because they don't get that kind of competitiveness, as they're growing up. They're skilled. They're really good. But they don't have that, you know, I would say as much that inner fire of knowing how to win, desperately at, you know, just winning a game. And I think that's a huge difference between now and what it was back then.
I could not agree more. You hit it completely. I've had this rant so many times on the podcast in terms of you look at kids today and you look at how skilled they are. The 12th man on a high school team today, what that kid can do with the ball in their hands in terms of ball handling and the number of kids that can shoot the ball from 3-point range. Compared to when you and I were playing in high school where every team had the 6'2", 230-pound football kid that just came in to screen and rebound. And that kid doesn't really exist anymore in high school basketball. And it's just the players are so much more skilled. And yet at the same time, I do feel like that competitiveness piece is one that's missing. And I do think that there's – I think the basketball IQ comes and goes with players today. There are some players that – I think have it, but I think there are others that because they spend so much time with the trainer and just working with some one-on-one and that kind of thing that they don't necessarily understand how all the skill they have translates into
right.
a 5-on-5 game. And so you start talking about that competitive piece and the idea of, hey, I'm at the playground and if I don't win, I might have to sit for 2 hours or I might just pack it in and go home. Whereas the AAU circuit, obviously you're playing. If you lose, you move to the loser's bracket. If you win, you keep going. Right. And so there's the games don't feel quite as urgent. I know you probably felt the same way, but I know when I was playing, whether it was a high school game or it was a summer game or it was a game at camp, whatever, like I desperately wanted to win every game because I just didn't play nearly as many games with an official and stands as kids do today. They just play way, way more. And to me, each one of those games was more meaningful. And I think that – that impacts you in some way. Again, I don't know that you can necessarily quantify it, but I do think that, as you said, that there's something there. And obviously you as a college coach, you're seeing that and being able to try to figure out how to instill that competitiveness. I want to come back a little bit to your playing career, but let's touch on that competitiveness piece. How do you do that as a coach? How do you try to install more competitiveness? How do you get your players to become more competitive? What are some of the things that you've tried and done and been successful with over the years?
That's a great question. I'm not sure I'm very good at it. we try to identify it, I guess, when we're recruiting. And you know, there's two situations where we're seeing players play, and one is the AAU summer situation, and the other is the high school situation. And I think you can learn things from both. From both aspects there, I think when in the AAU thing, you can see skill level. You can see, you know, if a kid cares about it. And you can see if a kid, you know, wants to compete in that situation as well. And you can also see if he doesn't. And I think in a high school situation where it's much more structured, much more, more coaching. And that's not a knock on the AAU coaches. The AAU coaches don't have time to do it because kids are coming from all over the place and it's basically all-star teams and they don't practice. Like, but in a high school situation where the high school coaches have a captive audience that, you know, you're going to see kids in a more organized, structured situation and maybe not being able to, display their skills as much, but you can see what their impact on winning is. So you try to recruit it. And, you know, when you get kids in your program, my philosophy has developed over the years because they do get a lot of the individual skill work from whoever, you know, away from our program, is that we try to make our practices as competitive as possible in 5-on-5 situations as possible. So I guess if there's a way we try to encourage that competitiveness and to develop it, it's in practice in those situations.
It's almost like you're replacing what you and I might have done sort of organically. You're trying to replace that in the practice setting by just giving kids opportunities to compete. That makes total sense. All right, let's go back to your journey as a high school player. When does college basketball get on your radar? Was it something that you always thought, hey, I want to have an opportunity to play college basketball? Or was it, hey, I'm not sure I'm really ever going to be cut out for this, but then boom, you hit that shot, you start to work on your game. Now suddenly maybe it becomes a reality. Just talk about a little bit about your process of how you ended up at Ohio Wesleyan as a player.
Yeah, so it did become a reality as I worked hard between my junior and senior years. Again, went from being a seventh, eighth man who, you know, made a shot to help his team win a sectional championship to averaging 18 points a game senior year. And I got some, you know, some Division I interest, meaning they sent a GA to watch one of a couple of our high school games, a couple of different, you know, smaller D1s. Immediately they saw my talent level and called their buddies at the D3 level. And that's where I was heavily recruited by a lot of Division III schools. Actually initially went to Wittenberg, for 3 years, which my thought process going to Wittenberg was I wanted to play in the winningest program I could possibly find. And that was the one at the time that was winning a lot. And, you know, I had a good experience at Wittenberg, but it ended up not working out for me from a playing time standpoint. And so I transferred to Ohio Wesleyan for my last 2 years.
How do you use that experience when you're talking with recruits or talking with your current players about guys who, hey, make sure you find the right fit? And then conversely, when you have guys maybe who aren't playing as much as they'd like to, what do you do in terms of your conversations with them to sort of keep them steady and keep them engaged so that you know you can keep them part of your program?
Yeah, first, I'm super honest with them about that. Like, and I never want to keep a kid from transferring, and I never want to discourage a kid from transferring. And I think back when I played, transferring almost had a certain stigma about it, that you must have been an attitude problem or whatever. And that wasn't the case in my case, I didn't think. And I had a good experience going from one program to another. And so even before the transfer portal was super popular and all that stuff, like we would, you know, if a kid emailed me about, you know, discussing a transfer, I felt like I was pretty open and would be pretty open to that opportunity because it's not always a bad thing. I also feel like as a, you know, drawing on my playing experiences as a coach, like I've experienced as a player way back when every kind of role you could have. I was the last guy who never played. I was the best player. I was the guy who had to play a role. When I got to Wittenberg, I was one of the best freshmen they had. I was one of only two freshmen to play on the national runner-up team. But by the time I was a junior, I wasn't playing at all. So I, I, I've, I feel like I try to, and I do try to relate those experiences to our guys. And I think I have a good understanding of where our guys are mentally, if wherever they are in a program, if they're starting, if they have a role off the bench, if they're not playing at all, and be able to relate to them that every single role is important and that you're important to our program. You know, again, having that experience in my background as a player has helped me relate to everybody on our team because I've experienced it.
Yeah, I love that from a standpoint of using your own experiences to be able to relate that to players. And obviously, as the older we get, the less maybe relevant those stories become in terms of, but you can still take those ideas and kind of how you felt in each one of those spots and be able to share that with players in a way other than saying, hey, remember when I was a player? Because players obviously,
exactly.
Players get very tired. They don't want to hear about you as a player. You realize that very quickly when you become a coach.
Yep. And I don't tell any stories about me as a player. Like, but in my mind, I know right. like that I've been through what this kid is going through. Like, hopefully I can help him.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do that. So.
No, that makes complete sense. And I think that the other thing that I really love that you said, and I think it's so important for coaches, and I know it's one of the things that for me early on in my career, when I was coaching, it was something that was, I think, difficult for me, is to be able to have those honest conversations and be very, very blunt about kind of where kids stand. Because I think young coaches, and I know I was guilty of this, is you kind of feel like, oh, I don't really want to let this kid down and tell him, oh, this is how it is and you're not going to play. And you kind of always want to give him hope. But ultimately, I think what you end up doing is you end up confusing them. And then when you have players who are confused, then that's where you get these seeds of doubt. And that's when you get them talking. I don't understand what coach is doing. And it just, it breeds a lot of discontent. Whereas if you just come right out and say, hey, this is where we think you're deficient, or this is the reason why you're not playing. Now there's no doubt in the kid's mind. Plus you give them a blueprint for what they can do to try to earn more minutes or try to work and improve their game. So I think those honest and blunt conversations to me are critical to anyone's success as a coach.
Yeah, it took me a while to learn that as a young head coach, which we'll probably get into in a second. Like I wanted all my players to be happy. I wanted them all to like me. I wanted them, you know, to, you know, have a great experience in our program. That's just not realistic sometimes. As I've gained more experience, and I use that phrase as opposed to getting older, but as I've gained more experience, I feel like, you know, I just feel like, you know, it's an old phrase, honesty is the best policy. And if someone is in our program and not happy because they're not playing, then that's okay. Like if they can find another situation that's better for them, I would encourage them to do that, and vice versa. But the honesty starts when you're recruiting them, and can certainly continues on to when they're in your program. But I just think that that's better for everybody. Like you said, you hit on it. Like you don't want to give young men false expectations about how good they are, or, you know, what hope they have to play. Like you just want to lay it on the line and be honest.
And I think players appreciate that. That's the honest truth, is
they
may not necessarily love that conversation in the moment. Nobody likes to be told, hey, you're not good enough, or this guy's better than you, or you need to work on this. Nobody loves to hear that. But I ultimately think that players do appreciate the fact that you're not trying to play games with them. You're just coming right out and saying, hey, here's how it is. And then that also opens the line of communication, right? Where a player can, I think, feel more comfortable than talking to you, because they know that if they come in and they have a question for you, that they're going to get a straight answer, as opposed to if you're kind of dancing around the issues or you're not really telling them the truth. I think that cuts off the line of communication. At least that's what's happened in my experiences.
I agree. And I feel like a lot of players, they always say they want a coach, you know, to be honest with them. And I tell them, okay, I'm going to be honest with you. You need to handle it. And that develops, I think, a mature relationship, you know, when you're dealing with 17, 18 year old kids, or in our case, 20, 21 year old kids. Like, I'm backing up what I told you. I'm going to be honest with you. So you need to be able to handle it. You need to be able to talk about it with me. And you need to have that kind of relationship. If you're going to be in our program, and if I'm going to coach you.
what were you thinking about when you were in school? Was coaching kind of always on your radar and kind of knew that was your career path? Or was it something that as your playing career ended, you looked around and were like, hey, I got to figure out a way to stay involved in the game? How did you come to coaching?
Great question. So after I transferred to Ohio Wesleyan, had good success at Ohio Wesleyan, was honorable mention, all conference a couple of years, was in a program that was up and coming. And the year after I graduated, Ohio Wesleyan won the Division III National Championship. And I actually graduated from Ohio Wesleyan with a degree in accounting, had a job in accounting for probably a year, but just missed not necessarily basketball, but just missed being around athletics. So during Ohio Wesleyan's championship run that year, when I was out working, I would come back on weekends and watch games. I ended up doing a little bit of scouting for the program that year. This is, you know, kind of an advanced scout going to see the team they were playing next, and realized, like, I, you know, as much I was doing really well as an accountant, kind of probably advance in that profession and make a lot of money, a lot more money than I'm making now. and just missed the competitiveness, missed being around it. And so I decided to quit my job and go get a master's degree at Ohio State in sports administration. And worked like a ton, like not a ton, but several just odd jobs to pay for it. But I also started my career as a volunteer assistant coach at Ohio Wesleyan, not knowing that I wanted to coach, but kind of just knowing that I wanted to be around athletics. And I had, you know, I was going to get a master's degree in that sports management, and I was going to see where that took me. But somewhere along the line during that time, I fell in love with coaching. I was, like I said, a volunteer coach for a couple of years at my alma mater, and learned a lot, thought I could have an impact. And especially at the Division III level, I didn't really have any, misconceptions that I was going to be, you know, an assistant coach at Ohio State or that kind of thing. But, just kind of gradually figured out this was something I could do and something I could, feel like I could have a positive impact on programs and on players, and something that I could do and fulfill a little bit of internal competitiveness that we all have. That started there, right after I graduated.
What would you say was something that you were good at when it came to coaching right out of the gate? It sounds like maybe building relationships and having an impact was something that you initially were attracted to. Is that accurate?
Definitely. The coach at Ohio Wesleyan at the time is the Hall of Fame coach, Gene Mahaffey, who was exceptional at X's and O's and organization. But one of the things that I helped him with and our other assistant coach did was being able to communicate with the players at the time, who were, you know, only a couple of years younger than me. And that was probably my main strength at the time. And so, again, that just having that relationship and doing that and being able to kind of be a liaison between the head coach and the players was my initial role. I think did that well enough to move on in my career for sure.
Your next opportunity is at Kenyon, correct?
Correct. I went from volunteering at Ohio Wesleyan to getting a full-time job at Kenyon. And I use full-time in the loosest possible sense because it was a $10,000 a year job, being the top assistant, and but also being the head golf coach, which wasn't all that bad. Just spent a lot of time, driving golf teams to golf courses.
There you go.
Sitting in clubhouses. But
those are the plum jobs. Every high school basketball coach is looking for that golf job, right?
Isn't it? That's for sure. I had it. But went to, like, extremely lucky to go to Kenyon at a time when they were on the verge of being unbelievably good. I worked for a coach named Bill Brown, who, there were two Bill Browns in Division III coaching, and one was a longtime coach at Wittenberg, and one was a coach at Kenyon. And I obviously worked for the guy at Kenyon who had a big Division I background, who was completely the opposite of Coach Mahaffey at Ohio Wesleyan in terms of organization. And, you know, at Ohio Wesleyan, Coach Mahaffey would have the practice plan. You know, we would start practice at 4 o'clock and we'd do the first drill at 4:07. And, you know, it was just incredibly organized and down to the minute. And my first practice at Kenyon, you know, Coach Brown was like, well, what should we do today? And I'm like, I don't know. Like, what'd you do last year? And so it was a great learning environment for a young coach, like myself. And we had some really good players. My first year there, I think we were 16-11, but my second year we were 24-4, won the conference tournament, made the NCAA tournament for the first time in Kenyon's history. But as again, the only assistant coach there, was given a lot of responsibility, a lot of, you know, a lot of stuff thrown on my plate in terms of X's and O's, in terms of recruiting, in terms of, you know, just doing everything that the head coach just didn't want to do or whatever. So it was a great experience to be able to do that on a team that was having a ton of success.
Did you take notes and start to collect things that you felt could be valuable to you as you moved on in your career, whether that was moving on if you were going to be an assistant, or I know eventually here you're going to get a head job in just a second.
Yeah.
About, but just, did you have a system for sort of cataloging what you were learning, or was it maybe less formal at that point?
It was less formal. And I listened to your podcast with Chris Sullivan the other day, and I love Chris, and Chris is way more organized, and he was obviously way more organized at a young age than
he's got the Google. He's got the Google Drive advantage, though, Mike.
You didn't have any of that back in the day.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely not. It was more for me. It was more mental, you know. But I'm sure I did write some stuff down about more X and O stuff than anything. But it was just happening so fast, and so much was happening at the time that I was just trying to absorb everything. Not knowing that my next job was going to be a head coaching job, honestly. Like, I thought I was going to be an assistant there for, you know, more than 2 years, certainly. But the opportunity at Hiram came up, and, you know, I'll go into that too. Like, I was completely unprepared for that. Maybe I should have taken more notes. But thrown into a situation at Hiram where I think some other people had turned the job down. They were coming off a pretty successful, they had a successful group that had just graduated and won like 18 or 19 games. And I think Mike Marcinko had just left and gone on to the high school level. And it was a complete rebuilding job that I was probably not ready for, but certainly grateful for the opportunity to kind of experiment on the fly, so to speak, at Hiram.
All right. So there's always, when you have this conversation of going from being an assistant to being a head coach, there's clearly a huge jump. You just talked about it. You felt unprepared as you take the job. What do you remember about being overwhelmed by, or being surprised by, or just not being prepared for? Are there one or two things that stood out that you were like, man, I had no idea this is what it was going to be like?
Yeah. I mean, there's so many moments that kind of, you're like, oh crap, I'm a head coach now. Like, and it's, you know, the guys actually like are trying to do what I say, and they like are hanging on my every word. Like, I better be prepared for them. And that's, you know, when I, again, going into Hiram, they had, you know, I don't want to say it was rebuilding, but a lot of guys who hadn't played in the last couple of years, who now it was their turn to get an opportunity, and they were super receptive to what I was trying to do as a coach, even though, again, I'm being super honest, I'm not, you know, God just didn't know what I was doing a lot, but it was all about having relationships with the players and being honest and developing, that type of coaching mentality. At the time, Hiram was in the Ohio Athletic Conference, which, one of the best conferences in the country. And we weren't very good. We got some upset wins, but it was, just the whole, you had to stay within the budget, like that kind of stuff that I hadn't dealt with at Ohio West Center, Kenya. And all of a sudden, we can't take a charter bus everywhere, like that kind of stuff. I had those conversations with our athletic director, and she's just like, no, you can't do that. So those kind of things, like, you just have to experience them before you can learn them. And that's, my 2 years at Hiram, I certainly learned a lot.
In addition to learning from experience, what other things were you doing, or maybe even do you do, as you think about trying to improve as a coach? What are some things that, whether it's talking to mentors, to reading, film work, what did you do at that time to be able to improve your craft?
I think I talked to a lot of people about our team, about, how to be successful at this level, how to recruit. That was a big thing too, was I had to be I was doing the groundwork with the recruiting, but I also had to be the guy to convince guys to come play for us. And that, again, that was a step that I hadn't experienced yet. Using mentors, and I feel like one of the things I've developed into is a mentor for a lot of people, and I hope we'll get a chance to talk about that. But I think, just talking to people and not being afraid to reach out to coaches maybe you didn't know. And I had a great experience, not with any one particular person, but with a lot of people, just being willing to talk to me about what exactly was I doing and how can I make myself a better coach. And I still to this day feel like, you hear the phrase lifelong learner. Like, I still do that to this day. I'm one of the things I'm kind of proud of is I don't feel like I know everything right now, even though I've been doing this for a long time. And if I ever get to that point, I hope somebody tells me and they slap me on the head and say, you don't know everything. But I think that's one of the great things about this profession is that people will help each other. And I certainly experienced that as a young coach.
Yeah, I could not agree more. That's been one of the things that, I don't know if it was surprising to Jason and I when we started doing the podcast, but just the fact that people are as open as they are and that they're as willing to share things that they're doing and be able to, I think what it comes down to is that most people who are coaching at any level, they love the game. And so, yeah, they want their team to be successful, but they also want to see the game of basketball succeed. Yep. They want to see the people who are involved in the game of basketball succeed. And that's one of the things that I found to be, again, the most refreshing with doing the podcast is just talking to people. And there's so many people out there at every level that are just willing to share what they know because they care so much about the game and they want to lift the game up. And when you lift up a person who, especially, again, a coach who has more experience, being able to reach back down to a coach who's just starting out their career, be able to lift them up.
Yeah.
Why don't we talk about that right now? Let's, before we jump to you moving over to center as the head coach, talk a little bit about the mentorship that you've been able to provide over the course of your career to players. I think this is a good point to do that.
Yeah, sure. And like I said, I'm proud of the fact that a lot of my former assistant coaches and players are coaches, whether at the college level or the high school level. And one of the things I think is important is preparing people that work, I like to say, work with me, for head coaching positions. What I try to do is just give our assistant coaches a lot of responsibility and make them more prepared than I was 30 years ago to become a head coach. The head coach at Ashland College, John Ellenwood, was my first full-time assistant at Ohio Wesleyan. And he had some other jobs before he got the Ashland job, but he's always thankful that I gave him his start in coaching. John Vanderwall at Marietta probably has one of the best Division III programs going right now. He was a full-time assistant after Coach Ellenwood was. And then, you know, I have Nate Conley, who's the head coach at Manchester, who was my assistant for 7 years when we were really, really good here recently. Just won the conference at in the Heartland Conference in Indiana. So, like, I feel like I, you know, those guys go on and they have success, and I'm proud of that. And I think that's really, really important. One of the things I've also had the opportunity to do in my career is I've spoken at the NCAA Basketball Coaches Academy, which was before COVID, but they have young coaches come down to Tampa, which going to Tampa for a couple of days in April isn't a bad thing, but being able to talk to young coaches about like work-life balance and how to, you know, go forward in your career, and just being super flattered that the NCAA asked me to kind of be a panelist down there and be able to share some information was really humbling. Then, you know, I'll continue to do that as long as they ask me. But again, just giving forward to, you know, people back in my younger days who you could call up a Division I coach and they'd let you come to practice. Like, I thought that was the coolest thing in the world, and I did that all the time and try to be that way with younger coaches today.
Easier to do that today in terms of the delegating to your assistants and helping them to grow and develop? Because I think that one of the things that when we've talked to other coaches, they told me a little bit about how, you know, early in their career, I think when you're driven to be successful and you're ambitious, especially when you have a background as an athlete yourself, you kind of want to do things yourself because you think you can do it the best. And I've talked to so many coaches, Mike, yep, told me, you know, hey, when I was younger, I had to control everything. And really my program and my coaching went to another level when I sort of allowed myself to give up some of what I used to feel like I had to control. So is that kind of what happened with you over the course of your career, that you got better at that delegation piece?
Absolutely. That's a great point. And when I was at Hiram and later at Center and in my first couple of years at Ohio Wesleyan, like, I did want to do everything myself. And then some of that I think was necessary because it was kind of building each program in the way you wanted to mold it. And then I think as I've gone on in my time and been established here at Ohio Wesleyan, I've gotten way more comfortable at being able to delegate a lot of things, and, you know, delegating meaningful things too, not just, you know, hey, sending an assistant coach to go recruiting because I don't want to go that night or something like that. Like, that's not helping a young assistant coach get better, but, you know, meeting with the assistant coach every day to have his input in practice planning or letting him know we actually have a budget and we can't do this and here's what it looks like. And so this will help you become a coach. But yeah, you're exactly right. That's something probably it's definitely something I did not do in my younger days. I was going to do it and I was going to take the blame if things didn't work. But you know, when you're young, like you said, you're trying to prove yourself and all those things, like you're not going to delegate as much as you do later in your coaching career.
What are some of the bigger picture things that you share with young coaches, either the ones that are on your staff or just as you mentioned, when you're going and you're giving a speech at a clinic? What does that look like in terms of some of the things that you're talking with young coaches about?
I think the one thing is actually have a bigger picture in mind, and not just, you know, get in the grind, you know, the grinding and the day-to-day stuff is necessary and it's great and you need to do that stuff. But what is your overall philosophy? Have a philosophy, whether it's the same as mine or different than mine. You have to have a philosophy about how you want to coach and, you know, playing wise, player relationship wise, all everything. And I think that's the first thing. And one of the things that I've over the years, secondly, kind of gotten into is have work life balance. You know, it's not worth it to spend 20 hours a day coaching basketball if it's going to destroy your home life or whatever. And like, you know, you can be a good coach, you can be a championship coach and still have a great family situation and have a life outside of it. And I think that's I think that's something a lot of people, and especially a lot of young coaches, need to hear. Because, you know, I just think that, you know, there's a bigger thing than basketball and all this. And it's, yeah, we want to win. We want to do the right things. We want to treat our players the right way. But, you know, you also want to kind of sometimes get away from that a little bit.
How do you fight that? Because I think especially today, when you look at the ease of being able to just watch film, for example, compared to when you started your career and you were trying to hit the fast forward button and the rewind button and you were going past the play that you wanted a million times. I always laugh because I can remember sitting in the locker room as a player, and I can remember doing it as a coach early on in my career too, where you're trying to watch film with your players and you got the VHS tape and you hit rewind and it goes a minute past the clip you wanted to watch. And it's just, I just remember it being totally brutal. And obviously now you have so much more access to be able to watch things. So how do you sort of train yourself, for lack of a better way of saying it, to have that balance to be able to step away when it's so easy? Everything's right there at your fingertips. You can always watch one more play, one more half, one more game, one more opponent. How do you train yourself not to do that?
Yeah, it's training yourself. It's self-discipline. It's, you know, scheduling. Okay, you know, I'm going to focus on basketball from 7 to 8 tonight, or 7 to 9, and then, you know, I'm going to spend time with my wife and daughter. Like, I'm, you know, after that, like, I think you have to develop that self-discipline in order to do that. And even, you know, even if you're, I say, only doing it a couple hours a night, you're still doing as much as anybody else. And I think, you know, and then, you know, I don't think sometimes, I don't think more is always better, but I think smarter is better. And if you can do things smart and, you know, have a plan, that you don't have to spend hours upon hours doing this.
Tell me about your experience at center and then how that leads to the opportunity to come back to Ohio Wesleyan as the head coach.
Yeah. So at Hiram, we, my second year at Hiram, we played in a tournament down at center. And for whatever reason, we played the two best games of my career at Hiram. We actually beat the home team by 20 and beat the number 10 team in the country in the championship game. And after that game, the athletic director, met me outside the locker room and said, "I don't know if you know this, but our coach is retiring. Super, you know, I was super impressed with your team. We'd like you to apply." And, you know, like, it was a hard, you know, it was my second year at Hiram. My career, like, my career record at Hiram was 15-35. And I knew we could be better. I didn't know how much better we could be. Center is a school with a lot of resources, they want to be good in athletics. They had been to two Division III Final Fours in the recent past back then. So it was something I was intrigued by, and I went down and interviewed and got the position, and had spent 3 years there. And it was honestly up and down. We were getting better. But I think I just have this etched in my mind. When I got the Ohio Wesleyan job, my career record was 50-75. So not, you know, some success at center, but not a ton. We were, again, building a culture and building a foundation for what has since become a really good Division III program. And actually, the assistant that I hired at center is still their coach, and someone I'm super close to. But so moving from center to Ohio Wesleyan was kind of interesting. Ohio Wesleyan had gone through a period where they were winning 7 or 8 games a year for like 4 or 5 years. Coach Mahaffey was retiring. It was going to be a job a lot of people went after. And I wasn't one of them. I was happy at center. I thought we were on the verge of doing some really good things. And the Friday before the job posting was going to close, the athletic director at Ohio Wesleyan called me. And it was someone, he was a men's soccer coach and athletic director, and, you know, just a legend in soccer coaching. He called me and he goes, "Mike, I can't find your resume." And I'm like, "Yeah, that's right, Dr. Martin. I haven't set it in yet, and I'm not going to." And he convinced me. He goes, "Just send it in and come up for an interview and let us talk to you." And it wasn't a mistake. It was like, all right, I'll do that. And once I got back to Ohio Wesleyan, got on campus. The interview went unbelievably well. And, you know, I got the job and was able to kind of come back to Central Ohio, where I'm from, go back to my alma mater, which I had a lot of fondness and affection for, and tried to start building the program back up.
Taking over as an alum, I think, is always special, right? Because you already have a connection to the program, to the campus. You feel, I think, an extra piece of pride. So when you get there, and Coach Mahaffey had been there for 20 years.
Yeah.
So there's obviously things that he had been doing that had led to a tremendous amount of success. And yet I'm sure as you get there that you kind of have your own ideas and things that you want to do. If you think back to that time, what do you remember as being one or two things that you felt like you had to do pretty quickly to start to establish what you wanted to do with your program there?
Yeah, there were a lot of things we had to do. And a lot of it just, you know, it stemmed from, it started with recruiting, and just getting Ohio Wesleyan out in the wild, so to speak, and getting in the game with a lot of high school players that I think we had fallen, you know, we had not done that, immediately before I got there. And just establish a culture where the expectations were going to be and the standard was going to be to try to compete for a championship. My biggest goal, quite frankly, was I wanted to get our program in the conversation with Worcester and Wittenberg. Because at the time, you know, Worcester's an unbelievable program, still is. Wittenberg, I think, is the all-time leader in Division III wins. And they had been the top two in the NCAC for a long time. And my goal is just not even to win championships, just get in the conversation. Just have people say, not just it's Worcester, Wittenberg, the two team league, the NCAC is a two team league. I wanted them to get us into that conversation. So in order to do that, we had to recruit. We had to recruit against them. It wasn't easy. It's still not easy. We had to establish a culture that we had expectations that we were going to compete for championships and kind of not back down from being good. But we wanted, I just wanted to do it also in the right way. And like we talked about earlier, just being honest about where we were, about the type of player we wanted, and know that it wasn't going to be a quick fix. And it took a while. But we did get ourselves to that point.
The first training camp Elite Skill Development and Performance Combine will be held on the campus of Western Reserve Academy, just outside of Cleveland, Ohio, powered by Unleash Potential and the Hoopheads podcast. The camp is designed for boys rising to grades 6 through 9 and will take place June 29th through July 1st, 2023. An emphasis on improving individual skills in the context of a team environment will be the hallmark of the training camp. Mike Klinzing from Head Start Basketball and the Hoopheads podcast and Joe's Decision from Unleashed Potential will serve as the camp directors of this inaugural training camp. Campers can expect 3 days of hard work, intense skill instruction, and learning how to be a great teammate on and off the court at the training camp. Players will participate in 10 elite skill development sessions led by some of the best coaches from across the country. Visit headstartbasketball.com to get registered.
At this point, so as you take over that job, it's your third head coaching position. At that point, do you feel like you had a pretty good handle on philosophically what you wanted to do, both from a basketball standpoint? Now, again, obviously, you got to get the right players in there to play the way you want to play.
Right.
But from a philosophy standpoint, do you feel like you had a pretty good handle on kind of what you wanted your teams to look like and what you wanted your program to feel like? Or was that something that you didn't quite get to it until you had been there a few years?
I probably didn't get to it until I'd been there a few years, honestly. I've always, at least from an X and O basketball standpoint, I think you have to tweak that from year to year, depending upon who your personnel is. And so, you know, I knew I had a general way of how we wanted to play. Like I wanted to shoot threes. I wanted to get up and down the floor, that kind of stuff. We wanted to be all, you know, mostly man to man defense, but mix in some zone. But, you know, I do think you have to tweak that. And I had to tweak it my first couple of years because my very first recruit at Ohio Wesleyan was a young man named Travis Schlopp. And he was, you know, from Edina, and he was one of those guys that everybody wanted to recruit at the Division III level because everybody saw the potential he had. And I still don't know why he chose Ohio Wesleyan, but I think it was to kind of have a legacy and help build a program, which he certainly did. And you know, he's a legend here at Ohio Wesleyan for what he did for our program. But he was a 6'6" post player who, when he got here, really could shoot outside of 5 feet. So we tweaked some things within our system to be able to take advantage of his skill set. And again, I think that's part of I think good coaches are able to take advantage of what their players' strengths are and maybe hide their weaknesses a little bit. So I did have a general philosophy about how we wanted to play, but we were going to change things up depending upon our personnel.
What about from a culture standpoint? Let's talk about what you do today to build the type of culture that you want. Day to day, what does that look like, building a culture?
Yeah, and that's why we've been successful, honestly. We have a culture. We talked about being honest. We develop trust amongst the players, between the players and the coaches through that honesty. We talk about effort and those kind of things. You know, when kids visit and when we have preseason meetings, like I do a PowerPoint thing with our guys that's probably 20 minutes long about just our culture and our values, because that's, I think at a place like Ohio Wesleyan, that is how you're going to be successful. We don't always get the best recruits, but the guys we get they fit into our culture. They're self-motivated. As you know, at our level, we can't spend a ton of time with them in the off season. So that self-motivation aspect is huge for us, and we try to identify that. And certainly we were trying to do that in the early 2000s when we were trying to build a program. And we had young men like Travis who were super self-motivated and super competitive to help us establish that early in my time here at Ohio Wesleyan.
What does the process look like when you start talking about bringing in the type of players that are going to fit your culture? I always think it's interesting to kind of go through, because I think there's some misconceptions out there about what the recruiting process looks like. So just walk us through from the very first day that you identify or put together your list of players, however long that list might be, the first group of people that you're going to look at, and then kind of how you funnel that down to eventually the guys that end up joining you.
Sure. I think, you know, obviously you're going to look at, are they good basketball players? That's a given. We do have a little bit of some academic restrictions at Ohio Wesleyan. It's not as strict as some schools, but certainly more strict than others. So we have to take that into account. But then it becomes, are they going to fit into what our culture is in terms of a basketball program? And I tell people this all the time, like we have eliminated recruiting guys if we've gone to see them play, whether it's on the AAU level or the high school level, if quite frankly, they've acted like jerks, you know, during that process, whether it's, you know, yelling at officials or yelling at their coaches all the time, stuff like that. Like those are not red flags for us, but they're yellow flags. Like we really hesitate because I'm not sure those guys are going to fit with how we want to go about doing things. And I think, you know, I think we've demonstrated that because like we don't always get those good guys who might be a little bit of a challenge to coach during the time. Because if I'm knowingly going to recruit someone over here who's a great guy who might not be a good basketball player but completely fits our culture, as opposed to a really talented person who doesn't fit our culture, I'm going with that first guy every single time. And that's something I've had to grow into as well, honestly. But again, I think it's made our program better that you know, because we recruit guys with the same values and the same belief in our culture that they're going to be good teammates and we're going to, you know, they're going to stick together through tough times and they're going to work hard together and they're going to like each other. And I think there's value in that as opposed to just being super talented.
Is that more of you guys as a coaching staff getting a feel for them when you go out and watch them, whether you're watching them on tape or you're watching AAU, high school, whatever the case may be? And then what kind of conversations are you having with their high school and AAU coaches?
Yeah, a lot of it's having conversations with everybody, you know, surrounding them, you know, and then trying to figure out yourself if, you know, you're actually being told, you know, the honest truth about it. I don't know if this has any effect on it, but I like going to high school games and not having the young man know I'm there. Just because I feel like I can get a sense of how, you know, that person really acts instead of him knowing there's college recruiters there.
And right.
He's gonna act a certain way. You know, that gets harder for me is, you know, I tend to stick out now as I go to games, especially in Central Ohio. But, you know, I try to get in out of there and just evaluate, you know, what type of player they are, what type of person they are, and, you know, get to know their families, get to know, you know, talk to people. Hey, what kind of kid is this kid? And, you know, people that you might not think you want to ask just because you know you're going to get an honest answer with that. I just feel like that's, you know, again, it's just the way I've done it, the way I believe it. It makes me, I have a clear conscience about the guys in our program. I know I'm not going to have any issues. So I'm not going to have many issues, I should say. So we try to weed that out as much as we can in terms of attitude and work ethic and being self-motivated.
How have you built your relationships with high school coaches in the state of Ohio and AAU coaches kind of around the area over the course of time? And how important are those relationships in being able to identify and get information about the players that you're recruiting?
Yeah, I think that's been a process and something that, you know, I tried to establish from day one here at Ohio Wesleyan, especially more locally here in Central Ohio. But as we've recruited the Cleveland area, the Akron area, the Cincinnati area, I'm getting to know people in those areas as well. And just, you know, just again, being honest with those people as well, because they're, you know, they're always going to try and not push their players on you, but encourage you to look at their players. And I think by just saying, I'm not sure, you know, he's good enough, or I'm not sure that's a good fit. You know, there may be other schools that are a good fit for him. You know, just being honest, again, I seem to be coming back to that quite a bit, but just developing relationships based on honesty, I think, is a good way to live life in any aspect. And I, you know, just being honest with those high school coaches. And I think, you know, that's appreciated as well, as we talked about earlier with dealing with the players, but dealing with the coaches as well.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question about that. Anybody that you can have an honest conversation with. And then obviously that helps too, going both ways, right? That you're honest with them about their players and say, hey, this kid can play at this level, or hey, this kid can't play at that level. And then you have, conversely, you want to be able to go to a high school coach and be able to trust that they're not pushing a player towards you that is somebody that has no chance of ever being able to play at that level. And so if you can build that mutual trust, then you've got a good situation where both parties can benefit from that honest relationship, whereas you can get in trouble really quick if you're blowing smoke at somebody.
And I think a lot of high school and AAU coaches know that too. Like they want me to, or college coaches to trust them. And if they're pushing a kid on us who's not good enough, like, and it's, you know, it doesn't work out, like that doesn't speak well for their ability to evaluate, for sure. And they don't want that. So
yeah, absolutely. And they also don't want to, I always think of it too, in terms of, if you're going to push a kid that's not good enough, then the next time you have a kid who is, that coach isn't going to trust your evaluation if you're pushing somebody who's not at that level. So I think it's something that, again, you're never going to go wrong with being honest. And sometimes it's tough, right? Because as AAU coach, maybe the parent wants you to push those kids to certain schools or to be able to at least get those kids in front of certain schools. And that's a hard position, I think, sometimes to be in as a high school or AAU coach, where you got to have that honest conversation. But that's certainly not an easy one for a coach to have with a parent, I would think.
No, I try to keep that in mind too, knowing that that high school coach especially probably is in that situation where the parent wants him, to get their kid recruited. And, you know, if he sends me an email and talks to me about that, hopefully he thinks and knows he's fulfilled that responsibility and we can move on.
But, yeah, absolutely.
High school coaches are in a tough spot. For sure.
Yeah, it is. There's no question about that. That, you know, dealing with us parents is not always the easiest for high school coaches. Let's put it that way. Yeah. Once you get a player on campus, we talked a little bit earlier about designing your practices to be competitive, but talk a little bit about your practice philosophy, just kind of how you think about organizing a practice, maybe how your practices have evolved over time from when you first became a head coach to kind of where they are now, if they've changed and how they've changed. So just talk a little bit about practice design and how you think about that.
Yeah, the basic design is we'll do, 15, 20 minutes of warm-up stuff with a basketball, preferably, whether that's shooting or getting up and down. And then we get into our defensive philosophy. I'm going to use the word drills, even though we don't do a ton of drills, but defensive philosophy. And then we have a segment in the middle of our practice where we just shoot, and then we go into our offensive stuff at the end. I've evolved, I guess, as a coach to where we don't do a lot of drills. We do a lot of competitive 5-on-5 stuff. And if I feel the need to stop it, I will stop it, and correct things kind of in a 5-on-5 situation, not necessarily a 1-on-1 or 2-on-2 situation. You're going to ask me why. I think players today, and again, sounding old and all that stuff, but I think they learn better when you have the whole picture in front of them, and in order to keep their attention, I want to have them engaged in the big picture. And so we have tried to go to a lot of 5-on-5 stuff defensively, offensively. Like if we're putting in a 2-3 zone, for example, like we'll put in a 2-3 zone and we will throw 5 guys on offense and tell them, move the basketball, and we'll cover situations as they arise. And then we'll watch, as coaches, we'll watch the video and get back at it the next day and talk about situations that came up that maybe we missed. But I think kids want to play. They want to play 5-on-5. And if I want them as a coach to come to, I want them to come to practice every day, I've got to make it fun. I've got to make it worthwhile. And you can do those things by still playing with a lot of effort and playing hard. And our guys, like I said, that's part of our culture and what we do. I also give our seniors, but a lot of times it could be juniors and even sophomores. I give them a lot of leeway to stop practice and correct something that's going on. And I think that develops leadership, which I'm big on. And I think that's one of my jobs as a head coach is to, develop guys who are going to be successful after they graduate from here, and they need to learn to use their voice and talk to their peers. And so if we have like our second team executing offense and they're doing it wrong, I don't mind it if one of our upperclassmen stops and corrects what one of his teammates is doing. And again, I think you get a lot of value out of that. You get a lot of communication between teammates. You get leadership development. You also get guys respecting their upperclassmen and guys that have been through it who have earned the right to kind of quote unquote coach along with me. But I think, again, that's a big part of our success as well, is just having that type of culture where the guys are invested in it as well as the coaches are.
Yeah, it's that player-led team thing, right? Where it's not always coming from the coaches. It's able to come from your players. And I think you make a really good point. And I think it's one that sometimes gets overlooked. And that's, we talk a lot as coaches about we want more leadership from our team, or we need to develop leaders on our team. And then I think a lot of coaches, and I know I've been guilty of this at times, is you
are trying to look for leaders, and yet at the same time, you don't always provide the space to be able to be a leader. It kind of goes back to what we talked about with delegating, right? When you're a young coach and you want to control everything and sort of have your hand in everything, you can't really hand off that leadership piece because you feel like, oh, it's getting away from me. And so I love the idea that you're allowing your players to be able to step in and sort of fulfill that leadership slash coaching slash mentoring role with the players who are younger. Because I think providing the space for them to be able to act as leaders, I think, is something that we sometimes overlook. You have to have the opportunity to do that in order to be able to develop as leaders. We can't just say, hey, we want more leaders, be a leader.
Right.
But then we never allow kids the opportunity or the space to be able to be a leader, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I agree. And it's kind of funny. I had a brand new assistant coach this year. He was great. And we were doing something like the first couple of days of practice. And one of my captains started, he basically, after I said something, he came in and taught one of our freshmen, like, how to post up and where he needed to post and stuff like that. My assistant's looking at me like, are you letting this happen? And I'm like, yeah, I'm letting this happen. Like, this is great. Like, this is how we want things done. And then, again, the best teams that I've had here in terms of wins and losses have been player-led the best. And so, again, that's something we try to develop. They've got to be able to do things without me telling them to do everything. That's the way I feel.
Yeah, that gets old really fast, too. Plus, it wears you out, and there's no way you can even realistically attempt to do that. So you hope that the lesson is learned, and then they start to internalize it, and then they're able to share that with players. And that, I'm sure, goes on and off the floor. And I know you mentioned earlier just talking about how important leadership is, because at the Division III level, you just don't have the opportunity to work with your guys in the offseason. So you kind of got to depend on developing those leaders in season, so that when everybody goes away and you can't have that contact with them, that those guys become the de facto coaches slash leaders, and making sure everybody's getting their work in and getting in the gym. So talk about maybe how you just approach those conversations with the leaders on your team, thinking about the off season.
Yeah, that's a great point. Like, the best example I could use is this year, like after our season ended, you know, I told our guys to take a couple weeks off and we'll come back from spring break and then get going with open gyms and strength training and individual workouts and stuff like that, none of which we can be at, legally. And so we identified our three captains, quote unquote, for next year, met with them. And they had already discussed with our facility director when they wanted to play open gyms. They had already split our team into like six groups of three to lift together, and already discussed times where they can come in and get on our shooting machine and then work out together. So without me having said anything, like, I didn't even want to talk to them for a couple of weeks until we got back from spring break, but they have already done that. And, you know, again, tells me our culture is in a good place, that we can go forward. But they learned that from the guys from last year, who learned that from the previous guys. And so it kind of self-sustaining, hopefully, at this point.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's key. Once you can get in and you've been at a place for a few years and guys start to understand what it takes and what your expectations are, then they can pass that along to the next group. And that's really how you get a program that continues to be successful year after year.
I agree.
It took a while
to build it, honestly.
I'm sure it did.
We had some lean years, my first couple of years, but once you got it and we've got it going, and there have been some hiccups along the way, but once we've kind of got it going, like, it's been really good, just from not only in terms of, like I said, wins and losses, but in terms of them growing as people.
What's been the biggest change in the coaching profession or the game, or however you want to approach this question? But when you think back to when you first started to where you are today, what's been the biggest change that you've seen, whether you want to approach that from college basketball, from your own coaching, just however you want to take that question? What's been the biggest change from the start of your career to where you are now?
Man, oh man.
Man, there's probably a million different directions you can go with that.
Yeah, I would say, probably just because I was just thinking about this, but I think social media has had such an impact on so many aspects of coaching, recruiting. You know, now when a kid commits to you, you have to put together like a little thing they can put on Twitter and Instagram that says they're committed.
Yeah.
Like stuff like that, which I, again, one of the things I look for in assistant coach is somebody that can do that stuff.
There's a delegation.
Yes.
A delegation that you don't mind delegating, right?
Not at all. but I think that also affects, you know, like I just, and I don't do social media, but I monitor it, if that makes sense. And I've seen instances where parents are criticizing their college head coach for not playing their son. And that, like, I was talking to my guys about that before practice once this year, because it was at school in our conference after this happened. And my best player goes, "Coach, if that happened, I would take my dad's phone away from me." Like, but it happens. Like, it happens all over the place. I'm glad I've got guys that would kind of step up and do that. But it just has such an effect. Like, people, you know, I need to get in a big philosophical thing about how it affects kids growing up today, but they're always trying to keep up with everybody else and visit this place because this kid visited this place, and I'm not playing, and I'm going to transfer, and all that stuff, you know, on social media, which didn't used to kind of be known in the public, and half of social media is not real anyway, and so I just think that's the one aspect. It's mostly negative, but it can be positive. But it's just an aspect that coaches have had to deal with, I think, more and more, certainly in the last 5 years, than I've certainly had to deal with before that.
Yeah, I can't even imagine growing up as a player in this era. When you go back to, let's start with just from a standpoint of being a high school player who maybe has aspirations of playing college basketball, and then just having to scroll through your feed and look at this guy's this offer, this, that. And you know, it used to be maybe you knew somebody in your hometown or somebody around you that was going somewhere, but you didn't know somebody across the state or somebody certainly across the country. You had no idea. Now you have 24/7 access to all that stuff. And so that's got to have an effect. And then I think the second part of it is, and you know, even I'm sure at the Division III level, but you think about what it's like for a college athlete who plays at Ohio State to be able to deal with, you play a good game and what you see scrolling through your feed, and then God forbid you play a bad game. And what those kids have to deal with and think. Like, you know, I played a game and I'd go back to my dorm and my roommates would say, "Hey, good game." Or if I played bad, they'd be like, "Hey, you only scored 4. What happened?" And my whole entire circle was 5 people that cared about what I was doing. And now you look at it, and anybody can reach out to you from anywhere and get their opinion in front of you. And I can't even imagine as an athlete trying to deal with all that on top of the normal just pressures and things that go along with being a college athlete. And then for you as a coach, I'm sure having to be able to help your players to navigate that when, again, it's really uncharted territory for all of us. I can't.
Oh, it is.
It's crazy.
And you're right. It's not so much at the Division III level, but like I really feel for like Ohio State football players.
Yeah.
Who just get like some of the stuff that see that they have to deal with on social media from fans. You know, it's kind of funny. Like, so we had a recruit 2 years ago, really a local recruit, really. We were really happy to get him. He put it on social media that he was coming to Iowa Wesleyan, and but it got like 800 likes, like on his Twitter.
Right.
And I'm looking at I like my job. Like, I think what I do is worthwhile, but I'm a Division III basketball coach. Like, we're a Division III basketball program, and 800 people liked that this kid was coming to Iowa Wesleyan. Like, it just seems like it's a little much.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, you see some of the stuff that gets out there when a kid commits or a kid gets this verbal offer or even a kid goes on a visit and stuff's up. And man, it's crazy the number of people that, as you said, like it and are seeing it, and kids are talking about it and this and that. And
It's kind of amazing. And then you talk about sort of the misinformation of, okay, well, what does that mean? Like, this kid got an offer from this guy. Well, what's that?
Right.
What does that really mean? And then you have this whole thing. It's just, it's funny to hear kids talk about it. It's funny to read comments and all these things.
Yes.
I think, again, we're adults and it's easy to get seduced by that stuff. And then you think about, man, what would it have been like to be a 17, 18, 19, 20 year old kid and trying to navigate all this stuff? I mean, it's a lot to put on their plate. So I think talking about social media as a big change, I think you hit the nail on the head with that one.
Yeah. And I think the other thing in the profession is that coaches are expected to do so much more than just coach basketball. At least in my experience as a college coach, like, you know, I've got to identify mental health issues, which I don't know anything about that.
Right.
Other stuff, like, you know, just there's so many other duties that are kind of, we're expected to handle that we have no training in. And that's a little scary sometimes.
It really is. I think education, both Jason and I are teachers, and that's a conversation that I have with people in my building all the time. Like, we'll stand and say, well, here's a situation with this kid or this student or this family. And people are coming to us saying, well, you have to try to help or figure this out, or this is what you need to do. And you kind of look at the situation and you say, I'm in no way, shape or form trained or confident to be able to deal with that. And it just, but to your point, that's what is being expected of coaches. It's what's being expected of teachers, is to be able to handle these situations that really there's people that are trained and go to school for years and years to be able to help. And the reality is there isn't enough of those people around. And so who are the people that are around? Coaches are around, teachers are around. Yeah. So we try to step up to the plate in those circumstances. But I'm sure that in your coaching circles, when you talk to other coaches, they're saying the same thing to you. And I know other teachers are saying the same thing to me. Yeah. It's like, you know, we're not equipped to be able to handle this stuff. And I can only imagine that as you start talking about, obviously all coaches say, a small part of my job as a head coach is really the basketball. There's all these other things that I have to deal with. And I'm sure coaches were saying that back when you first started your coaching.
Probably. Yeah.
But now at the same time, you look at what we all have on our plate. I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah, no, I agree. And that's, like I said, I've had to deal with some things that I'm just not trained to deal with in my life. Like, not what I thought I would be dealing with when I got into coaching.
Yeah, absolutely. You thought you were going to be coaching hoops, and instead you're like an amateur psychologist, right?
Right. No, for sure.
Yeah,
for
sure. There's no doubt. It's crazy. All right, we're coming on towards an hour and a half. Yep. I want to ask you one final two-part question. So part one, when you think about the next year or two and you look ahead, what's your biggest challenge? And then second part of the question, when you think about what you get to do every day, and obviously you've been at Ohio Wesleyan for a long time, so it's obviously a place that you love, that brings you a lot of satisfaction, but what brings you the most joy? So your biggest challenge and your biggest joy.
Good question. I think the biggest challenge, and I think this is a annual thing, is just maintaining our culture and the way we do things and not letting it slip, because it has slipped a couple times during my time here and it's hard to get back. So I'm very aware of that challenge and hopefully can identify issues and nip some problems before they even happen. So I think that's just an annual challenge that we have here, is just kind of maintaining our culture. Best part of my job is always said, like, is I think, you know, we practice from 4 to 5:30, 5:45 every day. And my office has a window that looks out over the gym. And we just got a new stereo system in the gym where our guys can put their Bluetooth on and play music. And
nice.
the best part of my day is when at 2:30, I hear music blasting in my office. And I look out my window and I've got 3 or 4 guys out there working out, getting shots up, where I can go down and just be around them without being in practice and just hanging out, getting to know them better, you know, working on whatever, you know, but it's a time where like you're developing the relationships that I think are going to lead to success. Like the best part of my day isn't practice. It's the hour and a half before practice when I can just hang out with our guys and get to know them better. I feel like, you know, we don't do like a bunch of individual meetings with our guys. I think that stuff's really formal and, you know, not genuine sometimes. But I think if when you get basketball players on a basketball court, you really get to know them for who they are as people, and you can talk about their families and their classes and stuff like that, and, you know, talk about, you know, the negative of having to deal with some stuff that I'm not trained to deal with, but that's the stuff that I still like, you know, in my advanced age and as a coach, that keeps me young, and that I think it's important to our success. So that's the best part of my job.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about it earlier, right? Those relationships that you build with players, and I think that having an impact on them, not just as basketball players, but as people, and by getting to know them and spending time with them and hanging out on the basketball floor, as you said, that's really where you get to know those kids, really where you get to build a relationship that allows you 100%. To have the impact that you want to have. And that really, again, that's what it's all about. Obviously, basketball is an important part of it. And at the college level, you got to win in order to keep your job. But ultimately, you're doing it to be able to impact kids with a game that you love, and being able to impact them as players, but also being able to impact them off the floor. Before we get out, Mike, I want to give you a chance to share how people can connect with you, whether you want to share your email, website, whatever. I know you're not a big social media guy, but somehow, some way, how can people get in touch with you? And then once you do that, I'll jump back in and wrap things up.
Email is mddewitt@owu.edu. And that's probably the best way to reach out. Our program has a Twitter and a Instagram account, which I can't tell you what the handle is on that, but you might be able to find it.
We'll find it quickly. And
easily.
We'll put it in the show notes.
And that's, again, delegate that to the assistant coach. But yeah, those are the best ways with just the email and our programs, Twitter and Instagram.
Perfect. Conversation's been a lot of fun, Mike. I really enjoyed it. A lot of good things I think we shared with coaches out there. So really appreciate you taking the time out of your schedule tonight to join us. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening. And we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Your first impression is everything when applying for a new coaching job. A professional coaching portfolio is the tool that highlights your coaching achievements and philosophies. And most of all, helps separate you and your abilities from the other applicants. The Coaching Portfolio Guide is an instructional membership-based website that helps you develop a personalized portfolio. Each section of the Portfolio Guide provides detailed instructions on how to organize your portfolio in a professional manner. The guide also provides sample documents for each section of your portfolio that you can copy, modify, and add to your personal portfolio. As a Hoopheads Pod listener, you can get your Coaching Portfolio Guide for just $25. Visit coachingportfolioguide.com/hoopheads to learn more.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads Podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.